I'm Christopher Lydon with Jamie Gordon, the long shot winner of the National Book Award for Fiction for her gorgeous racetrack novel, Lord of Misrule. The 40-to-1 payoff is for readers who, but for the big prize, might never hear of non-commercial fiction or taste the very different pleasures of it, which we're about to do. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jamie Gordon, your Lord of Misrule was reviewed in the Daily Racing Form before the New York Times saw it. Hasn't yet been reviewed in the Sunday Book Review. It may never make the airport bookstalls, but everybody who opens this book knows that it's the real old-fashioned American thing. Horses, jockeys, trainers, touts, with Damon Runyon names like Medicine Ed and Suitcase and Two-Tie on their own crummy horse track planet in far West Virginia. But then your language signals immediately that something very new is going on. I think the best way to begin might be just to ask you to read some of Maggie or Medicine Ed in their voice or yours, as you like.
All right. Well, we'll start with Maggie, who's a little easier for me to read. She is a college graduate, but kind of a drifter, about 25 years old. This is all happening in 1971. She's fallen in love with a horse trainer who just shows up in her life in a backwater of West Virginia and soon recruits her to work for him on the racetrack. Pretty soon they're living together, and Maggie finds herself working on horses all day long. But what had she done with her morning while she waited in the fly-loud barn for Tommy and the van man? Maggie had found a bottle of eye-stinging Brand X pink wintergreen horse liniment in the Pichot's tack shed, mixed, for all she knew, according to the late Gaston Pichot's secret recipe. And with it and strong fingers, she worked on Pelter, more or less making it up as she went along. Why did she so love the slant-eyed, bump-nosed horse that her hands wished to parse every inch of his famously long back? It was true she had no scientific reason to believe she knew what she was doing, but surreptitiously she did think so. For all her stamina, as a human girl, she knew she was lazy and unambitious, except for this one thing. She could find her way to the boundary where she ended and some other strain of living creature began, on the last little spit of being human, staring through rags of fog into the not-human, where you weren't supposed to be able to see, let alone cross, she could make a kind of home. Her hands felt their way blindly along the ridges and canyons and defiles of the spine, the firm, root-spread hillocks of the withers. She rolled her bony knuckles all along the fallen tree of scar tissue at the crest of the back, prying up its branches, loosening its teeth. And it must be having some effect. When she walked Pelter these days, he wasn't the sour fellow he used to be. He was sportive, even funny. She had walked him this morning until the rising sun snagged in the hackberry thicket. As they swung around the barn, she took a carrot from her pocket and gave him the butt and noisily toothed the good half herself. He curveted like a colt, squealed and cow-kicked alarmingly near her groin. "Okay, okay," she said, and handed it over. She was glad there was no man around just then to tell her to show that horse who was boss. When they were back in the stall and she turned to leave, she found he had taken her whole raincoat in his mouth and was chewing it, the one she was wearing. She twisted around with difficulty and pried it out of his mouth. He eyed her ironically. "Just between us, is this the sort of horse act I really ought to discipline?" she asked him, smoothing out her coat. "I simply incline to your company," he replied.
The horses don't quite talk in this book, but they come pretty close.
Well, I like it that people are perceiving the horses as real characters in the book. Those were my direct instructions from John Hawks, who was my teacher at Brown. And even though when I was a student at Brown, I was doing such strange, difficult work at that time, he disapproved. But after my novel, She Drove Without Stopping, we became close friends. And when I was about to begin Lord of Misrule, the very, very first pages I wrote of this book were in 1997. We just happened to both be doing one-month residencies at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. So there I was, actually sleeping 50 feet away from my first creative writing teacher. And when I told him, you know, I'm finally going to write that racetrack novel I've been threatening to write for, at that point it was 20 years, he said, well, make sure that the horses are real characters. Don't just write the book about the people around the horses. Make sure the horses are a figure in the book in some way. And I thought that was very good advice, and I took it.
You said that Maggie was in love with the trainer, Tommy, but of course she's really in love with that pelter.
That's true. That's true. I think in the long run she realizes that's a more requiting kind of love for her. Well, Tommy is a strange creature too. Maggie's attracted to things she doesn't understand. That last little spit of the human. And Tommy is off on some strange peninsula of being human himself. He's a very smart horse trainer. He understands a lot about horses and about power in the world. But when we are inside of his point of view, I think we see that he's this kind of scary person. We can see, I hope that the reader can see why Maggie would have followed him in the first place. But then I think she gets increasingly involved with the horses, and especially Pelter. Pelter is the one she really loves.
I want to hear something of Medicine Ed, who is this 72-year-old black lame groom around the track. Very modest job, but he is the voice of God in a way. He sees through the games. He mixes what he calls goofer dust to treat the horses with out of a long tradition. He writes his own and composes and prays his own version of the King James Bible. Give us some Medicine Ed.
This is a place where, early in the book, where Medicine Ed thinks he's gotten a signal from the powers that run the universe that he should bet his lucky money, $50 that he won on another race, on a horse whose name is Mr. Boll Weevil. That's because Medicine Ed is looking for a home, and the Mr. Boll Weevil in the famous song of that name is also looking for a home. It was no need for studying and dreaming. Often in the past, if Medicine Ed need to know about a horse, he could sit over a hand made of tail and mane hairs of the horse and tied with a red string and a hoof shaving and one green corner bit of his lucky money, push them around in hot candle sperm with a hoof pick under the light of the same white candle and dream until the answer came to him. But today was no need, no time. Soon as he heard the name of the horse Sino was running, he knew what he must do. He must ride his lucky money on Mr. Boll Weevil, who had beckoned to him. And somehow he felt he had to touch his lucky money just then. There it is, ne mind if it looks strange. He stumbled into the trailer. It was a 50 Zeno had give him last year when they stole a nice little race in the Poconos with Small Town Doc. He kept it pressed, flat and neat, between the lid and the waxed cardboard seal of a pickle jar of hedge beech leaf. The bill was evenly folded four times, so Ulysses S. Grant looked up thoughtful at you out of the lower left-hand corner. It was no use wishing it was 100 or a couple of hundreds. He'd seen better years than them with Zeno, and worse years. Thing of it was, he had lucky money. Like the Boll Weevil, he was looking for a home, and here was Mr. Boll Weevil in the four slot in the fourth race, beckoning to him. It was not a harming goofer that Medicine Ed knew the makings of. This ghost gray powder had never been meant to undo a horse. It was a root work of strong encouragement, of reaching deep into the lost harmony and milking up one drop of what was needed at the last. The gray rolled leaf, which stuck to itself like cobweb, came from a hedge beech in the old Salters family plot, hard by New Life Baptist Churchyard in Cambray, South Carolina. The tree grew sideways out of the grave of his grandfather, Eduardo Salters, greatest jockey ever known in South Carolina, born in slavery, killed in a match race in 1888. It sprung out of the grave dirt, twisted in the shape of a man riding, with one straight limb shooting out of it like a whip, and its leaves must be collected at dark of moon from that limb only. This jar was dried heartleaf. This one was horse mushroom. This here was boneset. The fine gray-gold sugar with specks of black peat in it was sand and shatters from the infield of Major Longstreet Park in that little arc of elderberry bush where Cannonball was buried. And finally he had needed blood of great speed, and what he got must have was good enough. This was the blood of Platonic, who he had rubbed for Whirligig Farm and who gave him his own bleeding ulcer. Platonic had scratched his fetlock in the gate the day he won the seashell, and Ed had scrooched down before he let the horse have his bath and scraped every black flake into this little bottle here. And that, once he mixed it to his recipe, was Medicine Ed's horse goover dust.
Including the powdered, dried blood of the horse Platonic. God.
Platonic is from the family of speculation. Horse breeders name horses in a family with names that are related to one another. There's a genealogy of horses in this book that's very important. A speculation grandson is a big deal. Speculation is a legendary racehorse of the far past. His son was Platonic, whose blood has been scraped into this little bottle by Medicine Ed. Medicine Ed actually worked on Platonic when he was working for Rich and extremely classy horse barns in the past. Now he's come down in the world, as has everyone in this book, but he still has a little bit of Platonic's blood, and he uses it in the book on, among other horses, Little Spinoza. Spinoza, as you can see, is a philosopher, so speculation, Platonic, Little Spinoza, who's the speculation grandson who hasn't risen to expectation yet. He's actually a very talented horse, but he has serious behavior problems and has quit in the gate, meaning he hasn't even started when the race was supposed to begin three times. So he's made his...
This is trouble.
This is trouble.
There's a whole world of connections here. I was wondering as I read this, if you'd seen the movie The Fighter.
I haven't seen The Fighter yet.
I ask only because that, too, is a tiny little community, really a family, in Lowell, Massachusetts, where old-fashioned boxing survives to this day. Like your Indian Mound Downs in West Virginia, an old American way of life is still there in miniature, but very, very true.
That's exactly what I was working for.
That's
in,
good.
In Lord of Misrule. There is a novel about boxing that was one of my models for this book.
Really?
That's Leonard Gardner's Fat City, which is about low-end boxing, the grimiest, grittiest kind of boxing in Stockton, California, and boxers who are at their desperate last effort to try to make a name for themselves, make a little money. And it's a very good parallel, actually, to Lord of Misrule.
These little worlds have their own language, their own rules, their
exactly.
own connections, their own taboos, their own mysticism, men, women, a lot of age range. I mean, there's something of Joyce's Dublin about these places, tiny little clusters of people that reveal a whole world. I was also reminded, I got to say, of the Pimlico track that I think you know vastly better than I do, but I used to go there in the 70s with Hubert Humphrey's doctor, Edgar Berman, and he had doctored all the prostitutes, a lot of the owners up there, you know, Edward Bennett Williams, I remember being up there, but that was a Pimlico particularly, and Baltimore in general, I hear a lot of Baltimore in this book, gave you that illusion of a completely independent planet. I used to say to Edgar Berman, if Baltimore sort of slid into the Chesapeake overnight one day, it would be weeks before anybody even noticed.
I completely agree about that, but hardly anyone knows that. One reason that I love John Waters is that he's one of the few artists in America who uses some of that old Baltimore slang, which didn't exist anywhere else. It wasn't in Washington. It wasn't in Philadelphia.
Yes.
It was only in Baltimore.
Edgar Berman used to say, "I have no idea." And then Russell Baker, the New York Times columnist, used to speak about the guy in Baltimore who was killed by his paramour. And you weren't supposed to know in the Baltimore accent whether that was, you know, his Toro out in the backyard, his paramour, or his paramour.
I love
his
that.
His girlfriend.
I love that. Well, I purged a Baltimore accent from my voice long ago, but I can speak in it if necessary.
The point being that you've created a world with a sound and with a quality about it that would be mistaken for none other. And then what did you want to do with it?
I wanted to write, with this book, a social novel of a kind. I wanted to represent, in one way or another, all the orders of humanity inside of this world. Mm. I think my previous books were usually dominated by one reckless human being, usually a young woman, whose fortunes would horrify and one would hope interest the reader. In the case of Lord of Misrule, I think that I was getting to be of an age where I could identify as much with the family less loan shark, Tutai. And Medicine Ed, who was looking for a home at the age of 72, not sure he's made the right career choice in being a groom for 60-some years, especially when he's not beloved of any white owners. So he's looking at a very unprotected old age. And I think since, as a writer, I felt that my career had never broken big, and I was getting into my 60s myself. Had I made the right career choice here? I mean, I didn't like Medicine Ed. I really didn't feel competent to do anything else. And I didn't, I couldn't have pictured myself anywhere else than on my racetrack, which is the world of American fiction. But I couldn't see exactly where I was heading. I think that the charm of the book, if it has any, is that the writer is fully as much inhabiting Medicine Ed and Tutai as the young woman. I used to be the young woman in my books, but now I was just as much the old guys looking into a kind of bitter and insecure unknown.
That's so interesting, and I wouldn't have guessed that. But every novelist should be as observant, as funny, as precise, as imaginative, with metaphor and just every kind of detail as Medicine Ed is. We were saying that the horses almost speak. It's one moment I love in this book where Ed is watching the horses into the gate, and he saw little Spinoza step into the 8 slot, civil as you please, like a man walk into a cloakroom to ask for his hat.
I always have felt, this isn't the first time actually that I have written about characters of all different provenances and social classes. It was kind of liberating for me. The first time I had a really crummy job, I was working illegally in a bar when I was 17 years old. Hmm. And that bar was on the eastern shore of Maryland. And it was the first time that I spent not some of my time, all of my time with people who didn't speak proper English. And I was amazed at the poetry that was available from it. It was one of my great epiphanies in life. So I think it's very easy for me to credit characters of any kind of background who are loners, like Medicine Ed, with having thoughts just as lyrical, just as poetic in some sense. I mean, they would have to be expressed in his language, but nevertheless, why should he be seeing any less than what I'm seeing? If he's an isolado, as I am an isolata in this life, a loner, someone who spends an awful lot of time thinking about things. And that he's bitter about the racetrack, but in certain temperaments, he feels that he's a lucky man because he's seen the secrets of the harmony of the universe. He has to be in a certain mood for that to be his dominant thought. Most of the time, he's just worried about where he's going to end up. But he's proud of his knowledge of, at least at times, he has strong senses of how things are interconnected, and it almost makes him happy.
He's insightful, and his language is so beautiful. He says oftentimes, I disremember the name. I disremember a lot of things. But he's also given to praying before races or otherwise when he's scared or when he's hopeful. And he has his own version of the King James Version. I wish you'd read any one of those passages.
There's a certain point where Medicine Ed actually begins to doubt. I mean, he's never had complete control of the effects of his goofer dust. He's had to admit he can always make something happen, but he doesn't know exactly what that thing will be. And I really leave it to the reader to speculate on whether Medicine Ed's goofer dust is causing these things, or it's just the nature of the racetrack that nothing can be predicted. But by this time in the book, when things are really desperate, if he throws the goofer dust and it causes the death of a horse, he would really suffer for that death. He's not sure what he should do. And this is a passage where he ends up with one of those prayers. For once in this life, he is not sure of his dust. What exactly do he mean to do? Is he fixing to goofer that red horse who is near used up anyhow? Should he see to his bankroll and help that old black stakes horse out of this life? He has knowed tired horses too proud to loaf. He has knowed sour animals that wanted out even if they still could run. But Nebraska, sore and tired, have that special hard heart, black as icy spades, which will hold him out past his burying day. And mean he was never nothing but alone in this world, with his bum seed and getting passed down owner to owner, all the way down to the ground, and he know it. And yet and still he want to live and do, he can't help hisself. Which medicine can sort the right end out? Which dust will serve? He cannot be sure. He need help, O Lord. And he try to pray from the 35th Psalm of David, loud over the young fools whispering, pick up my cause, O God, against them that's driving me. Fight against them that fights against me. Let them fall in the net they done stretched out to catch me. How long, O Lord, wilt thou stand there looking? Now get me away from these lions. Medicine Ed slips into the stall behind that black horse, Lord of Mercy, who is standing with his front feet in a tub of ice like he ain't have a trouble in this world. Medicine Ed limps fast as he can from south to north and east to west in the straw, first crossways of the world, then putting the world back right again. He has a handful of dust for each way of the cross, opens his hand, and blows. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I ask you to take all the bad luck off of me and send it back to the devil where it come from. Spare this horse if you can, but if hurt must come, make it go on them that would hurt me. I swear, O Lord, when I have my home, I am through with the medicine. Only this last time, do my work.
Thank you, Ed. Let us pray. Jamie Gordon, I want you to help us read this book in some of the not-so-obvious ways. I wondered, what is it that the horses and the people have in common here? Are they versions of each other? Is it partly that these are animals and humans that couldn't survive pretty much any other place? These horses couldn't pull a milk wagon or carry a policeman. What in the world are they going to do? And these people, where else could they survive? What is the correspondence, individually or as groups?
I want a reader who's really looking to notice that all the human characters whose points of view I'm working from are homeless people one way or another. Mm. Therefore, they need that little world of the racetrack. And even though they don't share all their thoughts with one another, that's why I try to create a sense of deep interiority with each point of view. I'm trying to create the sense that even though they don't, they're too suspicious, too wounded to tell everything to anyone else, and especially not each other, they are very tied up with each other. They're extremely aware that they need each other, that they're in each other's power. And the horses on a racetrack are also in someone's power. They're in the people's power. They're literally tied at all times. If they're not in a stall, they're on a what's called a shank, which is a leather strip with a piece of chain at the end of it. They're on tie chains inside of the stall, even if they want to keep the horse from moving inside of a stall. I try to create a sense that people are literally tied to one another in the book at times. And I think that the sex in the book, the sexuality of the book, which makes some people uncomfortable, also involves some tying and immobilizing and holding and at least the suggestion of violence, not unconsensual violence between Tommy and Maggie, but there's certainly the threat of non-consensual violence just outside of that relationship from some other men who are interested in Maggie. And this sense that in order for there to be a kind of cooperation, there has to be close to the surface this threat of violence. Mm. Well, that's how the racetrack works. I mean, these horses would not be behaving themselves as well as they are if they hadn't learned that long ago.
They weren't on a halter. It's funny, I had noticed this tie thing. Maggie speaks of the tie of ties. And then there's Tutai, a man who always has two bow ties on.
That's right. I forgot about Tutai actually coming under that same isn't that interesting?
In.
I forgot about that. Also, I want to say, even though we mostly think of tying as involuntary, all of these characters are doing, or they're at least at the last little tip of doing what they once wanted to do the most of anything in the world. They all love being around horses. Once Maggie finds herself on the racetrack, even though she didn't wish it for herself and has fallen under the enchantment of Tommy Hansel, she becomes completely preoccupied with the racetrack. Towards the end of the book, she begins contemplating a getaway, but only because she's found it so completely taking over her life. I do try to suggest, even for the horses, that there's a deep pleasure in doing what they do. I think that the reason that we empathize with the horses as much as we do is that they really want to run. That they, what the humans who own them and train them are capitalizing on is this trait that's been bred into them over generations of really needing and wanting to run and to win when they do run.
Do we want to talk about the eternal, or at least modern, lure of horses for girls in general, including my daughters, horse models, horse romances? I mean, it's sort of a stage for many American kids, sort of before they get to the boy thing,
it's
is
so
the
true.
Horse thing.
Interestingly, I wasn't one of those teenagers who demands riding lessons. That was not for me. It put you too much into the hands of grown-ups, and I was always trying to get out of the hands of grown-ups one way or another. Mm-hmm. Even though I loved horses, it was only when I was in my early 20s and, like Maggie, moved to a part of West Virginia that I liked because the physical geography of it had attracted me. And when I first moved back to Baltimore when I was out of college, I didn't want to stay in the city. I moved about 50, 60 miles outside of Baltimore to these Appalachian foothills, and then I looked for work. And like Maggie, my first job was working for a dinky little newspaper, the Frederick News Post. In the book, Maggie works for the newspapers in Winchester, another city that's very close
recipes.
To there. But I was also writing recipes for the Frederick News Post. And like Maggie, I loved that job. I was really sorry to give it up. I would never have picked myself for someone who would be comfortable working for the women's pages. But I love food, and nothing makes me happier than reading and writing about food.
Then I got to ask you to read that passage where Maggie is cooking beans.
Oh, I'd be happy
I love
to.
That.
This is a place where Maggie is alone in the extremely run-down trailer, which is so like the trailers that people live in on racetracks or did at that time, that kind of racetrack. And Tommy is away seeking owner's money in New York.
Is that where the expression seeing a man about a horse comes from?
Seeing a man about a horse. And this is why she thinks to herself, I really like this life and I'm happy with Tommy. But, oh, you know, it's funny that I only have this thought when he's not there, when he's away seeing someone about a horse. And then she's cooking for him. Maggie liked food, but food had to be offered. That was its nature. Therefore, menus by Margaret in the old days. Now she had Tommy, and these coarse, savory dishes powerfully expected him. He was in the beans, lazily seething and plopping like tar pits, in the braided loaves, bloating by the stove. She could cook, and yet she was not the homey kind. She was the restless, unsatisfied, insomniac kind. But when she came to rest, it was often with a ladle in her hands. She had been surprised to find out that beans and bread could bind anyone to her. But then, there had never been any telling what would bind anyone to anyone. Tommy also liked her collarbone and the flat Cossack triangles under her eyes. 3 pounds of beans, 3 cans of beer, 3 cloves of garlic smashed to a xanthus pulp, 3 smoked ham hocks, purple-striped, stiff and reeking like obscene little baseball socks, cider vinegar, thyme honey, hammered pepper, McNinch's Louisiana devil-aged intensified chili water from an old family receipt. In her family house, her mother had hardly cooked and had died young. Dry beans had been unknown, and Maggie could believe that the lifelessness of her childhood had had something to do with that fact, for surely sterile luck follows the exile of the bean. Beans, as the Pythagoreans knew, were the temporary lodgings of souls on the highway of transmigration. They sprouted beanstalks to giants in nameless upper regions. They were lots in the lottery for Lord of Misrule and his lady, King and Queen of Saturnalia, when the order of the world turned upside down. They were cheap. They were proverbial. They were 3 blue beans in a blue bladder. They wouldn't give 2 beans. They didn't amount to a hill of beans. They weren't babkas, which also meant goat turds. In order to feel like a savvy old crone in her own kitchen, a woman need know only 2 things, the stations of the bean and the imminence of a loaf of bread in a sack of flour. She had to know not only how, but how easy. Bread, bake thyself. Bean, boil thyself. Then she was free to fly about the snowy skies on her broomstick, while below, ancient arts uncoiled from her hands.
Oh, so beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much.
The phrase hysterical realism came to mind as I read this book. That was James Wood's description of Zadie Smith's writing, and she kind of embraced it. I mean, a kind of comic maximalism, every kind of effect exploding on every page.
That sounds right. And I think I was one of the first, by the way, to use that phrase maximalist about my fiction.
Really?
Someone really needed to do that when minimalism was all the rage, to claim maximalism as the contrary and proud of it, and I always have been.
What does it mean to you?
I don't see any reason why why it can't be interesting to observe everything that's happening in a original, internal, and
sort of everything into the bean pot.
Everything into the bean pot. I mean, one couldn't possibly register everything, but everything can be looked at in a new way. Curiously enough, it occurred to me, since people have been asking me about that with this book, where did I learn to incorporate tropes at this rate? I think that the writer that I learned this from, oddly enough, was John Updike. Believe it or not, not thought of as an experimental or an innovative writer. But I read The Centaur, which also won a National Book Award. I was surprised to see not too long ago. I had forgotten about that if I ever knew it. I read it when I was a college student in the 60s, and I noticed these very far-fetched, daring metaphors that one would have maybe expected to see in poetry, but that I hadn't seen commonly used in prose before. And I wanted to have that in my palette, and I cultivated it. That was, I think, my first influence from a genuine novelist in that direction.
Who else practices your kind of maximalism?
My kind, I don't know, because I also like novels in which a whole lot happens. I'm not. I've always wanted to have a plot and a certain amount of suspense in a book. Not everyone cares about that. I don't think the writer Catherine Davis, who wrote novels named Hell, Labrador, The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf, she's a writer who I tremendously admire. And she certainly is a maximalist in her prose, but she's probably not quite as concerned about making involving a reader in a process that forces the reader to read on because the reader must find out what happens. Another writer. Very rich in her means, not quite as well known yet, but I think she will be at some point. Kelly Wells, she has a novel called Skin and an earlier collection called Compression Scars. Joanna Scott is a novelist that I tremendously admire. Russell Banks is a writer who has. Riches of language,
yeah.
I think.
We like Russell Banks.
Peter Carey, who, by the way, was nominated for a National Book Award this year as well, who was a finalist, and I was sure he would win. And I think he's a wonderful stylist, and I learned a whole lot from him about how to construct lyrical sentences from small sentences and put them next to longer and more complex sentences. Yeah, mm-hmm. He's just a terrific writer, actually.
I have to ask you about not just the distance between a small press novelist like you and a big press, mainstream Peter Carey sort of thing, but also the difference. And I've been trying to figure out as I read Lord of Misrule, I'm astonished by the richness of language and imagination and feeling and power in this book. And I'm trying to think, why is Jackie Suzanne advertised in the Times Book Review and not you? Why are others with Random House and you're with this marvelous McPherson and Company, which consists, I gather, of one man named McPherson?
Well, I want to say that there are occasionally writers as maximalist as I am who, by the luck of the draw or the luck of who happens to be looking at any particular time, have come out from trade presses. Catherine Davis is one of them. I've often wanted to know her story, like what brilliant and faithful editor made sure that she came out from trade presses from the earliest novel in her career, which was Labrador, until now. And I thought I could be one of them. And I thought this novel, when I first finished a draft of it, which was 10 years ago, I thought this would be it. I thought that there was enough going on, that it was an exciting enough book, that it might actually have commercial possibilities. And after my agent had shown it to about six presses, and I don't think she was very enthusiastic in doing so, she came back and said, "Jamie, you just have to face it. You're a small press author." I was mad. We parted company, and I had every intention of getting a different agent. When I finally decided that this book had to come out and handed it over to McPherson and Company, I thought no one would ever see it. That was the saddest part of it. The trouble about small presses is not that they don't do beautiful books. This book, at least in its first editions, is even a stitched hardcover one. Hardly ever sees a sewn book anymore. And it has beautiful embossed end papers, and it won't fall apart when you carry it around in your pocketbook for months on end, as I do sometimes with novels that I love.
Not to mention this astonishingly beautiful cover.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it.
Oh, I love it. And it says a lot. All we see is a jockey on a horse. Not certain that it's a man or a woman, but it could be you on a misty track. That's all we see, basically. But it's, let's call it a girl jockey, alone with this animal, the writer with her work. It's enormously suggestive and true to the spirit of the book. And that took real care and thinking on the publisher's part, I think.
I do love the misty, boundaryless feeling of the whole cover, actually, the way that it wraps around.
But so what is the difference between little press and big press world, between you and Danielle Steele?
If you are lucky, and this whole book is about luck, there is no difference. But
the other thing I just want to say about a small press book that hits it big is it's a joy to sort of feel the quality, not only the paper and the cover, but the writing and the idea, and to think, holy mackerel, we talk about the end of literacy, the end of books. No. It's alive and well. We just haven't met it yet.
Well, I do hope that some people who find the experience of reading this book well worth the slightly greater amount of time will look at other books from independent presses, because I think wonderful work is being done. I mean, in some ways, we're in a golden age of letters. For better or worse, we live in a world now where at least 350 colleges and universities are teaching creative writing. And in all that activity, I assure you, there are some wonderful writers. I think that there are probably more truly interesting writers at work in America now than there ever were at one time. And we just have to figure out a way to help them into visibility and be readers as much as...
We do need something more open and maybe with better taste than the New York Times Book Review.
Well, the New York Times Book Review hasn't paid any attention to me at any point in my career. And I'm told that if they miss your book the first time through, it doesn't matter if you win the National Book Award or a MacArthur or anything else. They stubbornly will hold out and not review it. They didn't review Paul Harding's Tinkers either, and refused even after he won the Pulitzer Prize to review.
The compensating thing, I think, is the web. If you Google Jamie Gordon, I found interviews with you going back into the early 80s. Tremendous documentation of your work, appreciation of it, very lively, intelligent back and forth.
That's true.
We just got to wake up. Jamie Gordon, thank you so much. I loved the book, and I'm very grateful to all those writers who just plain do the work year after year until finally we discover how great it is. Thank you. Thank you for this conversation, too.
Thank you, Chris, for inviting me.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with Jamie Gordon. Her new novel is Lord of Misrule. Special thanks to Monica Higgins at the Boston Athenaeum for giving us a studio in their venerable stacks. The conversation isn't complete until listeners like you feed back with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.